this on the applied reproductive strategies. And a couple of years ago, I told them that they got to find a younger buck to go along with them, a bull with a little bit higher fertility than this one right now. So, but they said, but this is the first one in Virginia. Would you rejoin us? And frankly, I'm delighted to do it. I know many folks in the audience. Some of you I've even messed up in class at Virginia Tech. I hope not too badly. Anyway, it's good to be back, and it's good to rejoin this group again that I think so much of. They gave me the topic of inseminating factors affecting fertilization of estrus in cattle. And I'd like to say that we still have much to learn. And I wish that I really could go back to the drawing board and to the bench and with some of the techniques and tools that the scientists have today. Because you're going to find that in the next several years, there's going to be more and more breakthroughs in our understanding of this process so that we can ultimately improve reproduction through AI. But basically, one of the major questions we're asking, or what this bull is asking too, is what did you do with all those sperm? I mean, we put in a whale of a large number of sperm. And in the handling, in the way we inseminate, in the bulls we choose, we have influence over the outcome. I want to hit just several points in this presentation that might not give you any silver bullets to either a veterinary practice or to a producer, but that might be considered in your decision making. I'd like you to know a little bit first about what happens in the cow, or at least what we know about it in terms of the transport system. How do sperm get to the site of fertilization? I'd like to talk a little bit about the bull, the reproductive history, and the preservation of semen. The inseminator, another important aspect of this, is the placement and the semen handling. And you have a wonderful speaker on this coming up right after I'm on semen handling. So I start whipping slides out of my presentation because you're going to hear a very good one on this, but I want you to know it fits importantly in this process. And then the timing of insemination, the time of ovulation, the tightness, that is how little or much the variation exists, and the method of detecting heat and ovulation. In terms of sperm transport, if we put the reproductive tract and view it here, the bull would put the semen here in the fornix vagina, in this area. We, on the other hand, inseminate through the cervix, through these folds, into the body of the uterus. The sperm then migrate from there up the uterus to a region in the oviduct. We call it the lower oviduct or isthmus. And this is the sperm reserve. This is where potential fertilizing sperm reside prior to going up then higher into the oviduct near the enlargement. In this process, sperm numbers, whether it's the bull or even in AI, the numbers of sperm diminish greatly. The bull puts in billions, we put in millions, but we're only dealing with thousands usually that get to the isthmus of the oviduct. In this process, though, there's a selection going on. And that selection is primarily in semen quality, that not only are these a more live or viable population of sperm, but they are more normal in shape and hopefully in many other characteristics, but not all characteristics. In other words, the female has a method of selecting sperm, but her selection process is not absolutely complete. This region of the oviduct, we call it the isthmus, it's the lower part, and the oviduct gets larger as you go up. This is where these sperm attach. And some very nice work now, and these sperm will be released to the site of fertilization in a low number, and you'll see what the numbers are in a minute. But some nice work is going on in defining what kinds of sperm it takes to get here. And this is where viability and morphology are definitely improved in this reservoir. More importantly, the fertility differences among males are reflected in the numbers of sperm that are bound to this region. And the functionality of these sperm in terms of their response to changing salt solutions, their ability to capacitate, and their ability to hyperactivate, which is very important for fertilization. Hyperactivation, something you might not be familiar with, but a sperm usually, if you look at it under a microscope, is swimming like this. But when it becomes activated, the tail flails, and it looks like he's going nowhere. But a very nice piece of work at Cornell showed that when he attaches to the egg, that flailing pushes him through more powerfully. So the hyperactivation really is important to the process of fertilization. Our work went a little bit in further in this regard, in that we went to the egg itself. And, of course, there's only one fertilizing sperm, but there are many sperm that sometimes compete for the honor of being the fertilizing sperm. And what we recognize in these sperm is that they did get to the site of fertilization. They did compete. They could possibly be the fertilizing sperm. And to get these eggs, we do it as you would do it in embryo transfer. We flush them from the uterus about 6 days after we have inseminated the cow. And in this case, we would expect those embryos to be in the shape of a compact morula, which is sort of just a ball of cells. And what we can do then is take that egg, and we can look for the functionality then of these sperm, because these sperm that are in that outer covering of the egg actually are a select population. They were from that oviduct reservoir. They underwent egg recognition. They underwent partial penetration of the egg. The only thing is they got beat out. They weren't the fertilizing sperm. And the embryo gives us information, too, that will become important as we go along. We could get from the cow unfertilized eggs, or we could get eggs that differed in this morula stage from very poor to fair to a very excellent ball of cells. And the significance of this is, of course, the unfertilized ovum, that will not give you a pregnancy. And work has shown that the poor to the fair embryo will only generate about half the pregnancies of an embryo that is considered good or excellent. So there's different quality of embryos that also lend to the ultimate thing one is after in fertilization. Nature did not intend for a large number of sperm to reach the egg. If we look at the numbers or percent embryos ova recovered on this axis and the numbers of accessory sperm on the x-axis, you can see that while the average is 18, this is a skewed population. So really in that case, what you need to look at is the median, or what is the 50 percentile. 50 percentile of the cows were more, 50% of them were less than 3 sperm per egg. But the natural number, or the most common, was actually 0. So many of the eggs, only 1 sperm entered the egg. There was a little significance to this in the sense that as we look at the median, which we said was more important, if we look at unfertilized eggs, the number of sperm are basically not there. The egg is sperm hungry, basically. Degenerate to unfertilized, we don't know what these were. That's why we even have this category, but still low, so probably unfertilized. Degenerate embryos had 1 median sperm, 16 here, 5 fair to poor, 18.9, and 26.2, or 8 sperm per egg on a median in this regard. I want you to realize, though, in these, we've collected these eggs, 1,118. These are all single ovulating. These are not supers. These are single eggs. So a lot of graduate students were sacrificed at this altar. Anyway, what you also see is the noise. The noise is that these variations, 26 plus or minus 47, holy mackerel, 18, 40, that's the noise in the cow. That's the cow-to-cow variation. Huge. So, we did know that the numbers went up, didn't we? At the median, as they went up, we had higher success rate in embryo quality. And what we did was we started looking at all kinds of things. We tried to make efforts to raise that accessory sperm number. All of these had little to no effect in white or very little effect. The ones I want to spend time on are the dosage of semen, and that varies from zero to a very positive, and that's a bull effect, I should say. Select male, the male effect is the greatest on how many sperm get to the egg. Natural service also can be very great, but also can be zero. There are some males that can't get any more sperm to the egg naturally as we do through AI. That's a bull effect. The time of AI in singles and superovulated both has a great effect on how many sperm get to the egg. And the male interacting with the time of AI also has a positive effect. So let's look at the bull first. One of the concepts, and this started way back before any work here, it started with Salisbury in Illinois and then to Elliott and Sullivan in Wisconsin at ABS, basically showed that if you look at the y-axis and percent fertility goes up, and you increase the numbers of viable sperm in this direction, and you put the optimum fertility of the female population here, you see very marked differences between bulls. Bull A, for example, requires less sperm to hit the optimum fertility level of the female population than does bull B. They both are fertile, and they're both fertile to the same degree, but one guy requires more sperm. Then you have bulls that require more sperm, but they level off and never hit the fertility level. And still others, and when we start looking at these bulls, we're looking now at more natural service bulls that we know less about than we do AI bulls, which are usually compensated for by increased numbers. So what you could see between those two, and I just go back to this, is that we have differences among bulls that we consider they're compensable, that we can increase the fertility of one bull over another simply by raising sperm numbers. But then we have bulls that give us traits that are basically non-compensable, or it doesn't matter how many sperm we put in, he still is not going to reach the fertility. I want one message, if nothing else goes out of here, is that, that we have got to get rid of these bulls. These are the bulls that have to be eliminated through either very good BSEs or using AI from reliable sources. So the uncompensable semen deficiencies then are, by definition, those which can be overcome by increasing sperm dosage. In other words, the sperm in those samples are precluded from even accessing the egg or getting to the oviduct. The uncompensable deficiencies, these are deficiencies resulting in depressed fertility at any sperm dosage. And these signify that we've got incompetence in the fertilizing sperm. In other words, the guy can fertilize, but he cannot sustain the embryo. So you are not going to see a pregnancy or a cow back in heat. Bulls really differ, and this one is a puzzler. If I were to spend some more time, this is where I think I'd make my nest. But anyway, this is where you see bulls that under the same conditions of heat detection and insemination, that you have bulls that get enormous numbers of sperm to the egg, a median of 40, 52 plus or minus 61, and bulls with less, some with quite a bit less. This one is significant. These guys are not significant, but we know that they vary considerably below the 40. What is there about that bull? If I were to tell you that I could look at the semen of these four bulls and not see a bit of difference in how motile they were, or how fast they moved, or how many were live or dead, These were the same in that regard, yet this guy consistently got higher numbers. It's still a mystery. One of the areas that we do know contribute to the uncompensable effects are abnormal cells. In other words, when we see abnormal sperm, and this is why I stress the BSE and a major AI station where they pay attention to these traits. When we see these abnormalities, we think, okay, there is a disturbance in spermatogenesis in that bull. The interesting thing we found was that these abnormal sperm don't get to the egg. They don't even attach to the egg. They don't get to the site of fertilization. So what the heck? If only normal sperm are getting there, what's the problem? The problem is that when we see these in the ejaculate, the normal appearing sperm, such as this guy here, is also abnormal or incompetent in his ability to fertilize. And the female does not separate those out. She cannot distinguish cells that are normal in shape and are alive in other regards. Here is an example. This comes from an AI station quite a few years ago, before we really knew what these abnormals were doing. So we took a group of bulls, that were below and were average in a bull stud with regard to morphology. So those bulls that are average were the mean of the stud in morphology, and those bulls were below that average. I can't remember exactly what they were right now, but anyway, when we looked at the data from collecting the embryos on these bulls, you can see that the difference was not only in the below average or the higher abnormal bulls giving you more unfertilized eggs, it went all the way up, and it included also excellent to good embryos were depressed, that the average bulls had better embryos. So when you look at this scenario across users and pregnancy rates, you had lost pregnancy due to two things, fertilization and what? The ability to sustain an embryo. Both were involved. I want to end the bull side with this one because in beef, this is perhaps one of the major causes of the increased abnormals. It's very important that the temperature of the testis be maintained 5-6 degrees below body temperature. That's why we carry them outside, right? Well, you do too, unless you wear shorts or you go into saunas. And anyway, I won't get into that. But that is a major problem in male fertility in general. But anyway, one of the key elements is, and you've seen a bull in hot weather lower the testis, one of the areas that he's exposing is the pampiniform plexus. This is a plexus of arteries, an artery coming down, coiling, and veins going up. And this is where you get the exchange of heat. The cooler blood going up, the warmer blood coming down, and with the coil of the artery on the outside, a lot of that heat goes through that scrotal neck to the outside. Unless what? What can happen in beef situation that would preclude that normal thermal regulation? Too fat, too high a condition, overfeeding, getting conditioned to such that that fat deposition, particularly in the inguinal area, will greatly reduce that dissipation of heat. And the outcome of that has been seen very nicely by our colleagues to the north. Excuse me. Oh, geez. I covered the wrong thing. Excuse me. By our colleagues to the north in Canada, where they have looked at the infrared thermography of the scrotum, where they can see changes in the pattern of the heat. With infrared, the bluer, greener colors are cooler. And then as you get up into the reds and yellows, they're warmer and warmer. And with the infrared, and these bulls, particularly on the left here, had high fat deposition in the inguinal area. You can see how much warmer those testes are. And that, in their case, was nicely shown to be related to the abnormal sperm content. This one here was due to an infection, and I'm not sure what this one was. I had an explanation, but these were points of infection where we have isolated focal orchitis type of problems. The inseminator, of course, today we are dealing with a different dose. Some of you out there with gray hair, I think, recognize the ampule as having been a viable type of package at one time. But now we're using straws. And with straws, you have a much higher surface-to-volume ratio. That's a two-edged sword. It gives you better control over the freeze rate, thaw rate, but it also gives you what? A bigger chance for mistakes, and particularly in thermal, in handling. And Dr. Stroud's going to handle that. I'm going to stay away from it. But what I would like to say is that the deposition of semen is also important. Something you know, and in training, going through the cervix is one of the skills a good inseminator has to have. Well, why doesn't the bull? How does the bull put semen in there? And we did study natural service and sperm transport in this regard. And the bull has an ability to curl the end of the penis and scatter the semen into the fornix. He doesn't even put it through the opening that we pass the inseminating rod. So how does it go through? Well, it basically goes through by picking up privileged paths in the mucus that comes out. From that fornix, the cervix provides these grooves that go through the cervix, and those grooves have a different mucin coming out of the bottom than out of the top. In fact, the mucus in the bottom of those grooves is much more thin and watery, and the sperm follow those paths. And the mucus paths and privileged paths have been drawn schematically here. You're speakers this morning talked about the importance of heat and estrogen. And this is a product of estrogen. As you move from an estrogenic tract to a progestational or luteal phase, those paths disappear. They disappear. Now, fortunately, we're not going through the cervix like the bull sperm, because they go through these grooves. And if you were in the uterus watching sperm come out of the cervix after natural service, they'd be coming at you like a hollow cylinder, because they're not going through the center. The center is the worst place one can put semen, because what's coming through the center? The mucus. I mean, any of you that have bred cows, that mucus that's getting dumped, that strong mucus is coming through the center. And the only thing you see coming through there are the dead cells that don't make it through the grooves that are down below. So basically then, going through the cervix is very important to the insemination process. A colleague many years ago, Dr. Ed Graham at Minnesota, ran some nice tests on different technicians. And he separated technicians into those with the lower fertility versus the higher. And with a dye, he was able to look at where they deposited the semen. And you can see the body of the uterus, right horn, left horn, anterior cervix. Look at all the semen that was basically placed in the cervix itself as compared to the high insemination fertilization rate technicians, which was mainly all in the uterus, some in the right horn. He must have had more right-hand inseminators, because if you're a right-hand inseminator, you're going to tend to dump more in the right horn versus the left hand in the left. Anyway, an important finding, I think, that underwrites that. So one of the things I've done here is to say, you know, technicians or inseminators are not much different from bulls. I put them on the same chart that our bull ABC was on. And here, if you look at percent fertility, increasing numbers of viable sperm, and there's data to support this. I'm not putting it all into this talk. We don't have time. But there are some inseminators need more sperm than others. And if you're really bad and you do some of the things that Brad may indicate in semen handling or in deposition, you may never reach the fertility of the female population. What Graham also showed here that I think is important is that if you retrain inseminators, you can move them back to a more competent inseminating posture. So if you do feel that that is a necessity, I think any of the AI studs that serve you would be willing to retrain you and to recheck where you are putting the semen. What else are you getting here? I have low dosage, poor cryopreservation, and sorted semen. I want to say just one thing about sorted semen. We do know that sorted semen has been giving us lower than normal fertility rates. But I will say that there are being some, there are now occurring some seriously positive testing and developments that are going to move the sorted semen much closer, if not on the fertility. I don't want to make a promise, but we're excited about the kinds of things that are happening now in the sorted semen industry. The time of insemination, how am I doing? I'm almost out here. Time of insemination, I'll try to move fast here. We used the heat watch system because it gave us the actual onset of heat. I think most of you know that system. There's two experiments I want to discuss. One is the Dalton experiment with Holsteins. That was spontaneous heats with prostaglandins, and ovulation was 27.6 plus or minus 5 hours following the onset of heat. The Sertoli one was with Angus, the GnRH Cedar PGF, and that was 31 hours for ovulation, plus or minus 2.9. So the latter one was more tight and prolonged. The first experiment we'll talk about first, we bred at the onset of heat, 12 hours later and 24 hours later. The median accessory sperm followed 1, 2, and 4. In other words, it went up. Fertilization rate, which is not a good measure here with these numbers, but 66, 74, 82%. Okay? So it followed the accessory sperm. In this case, the accessory sperm went up, as did fertilization rate. But look what happened. When we got to 24 hours, excellent to good embryos came down, and the degenerate embryos went up. What's going on here? The concept or model that came from this is that if we breed early, we have a low fertilization rate and a high embryo quality, probably due to inadequate sperm life. If we breed late, we are breeding at a time when the fertilization rate is high, but embryonic quality is low. And we think now that that is due to an aging egg, that we're getting too close to ovulation. In this scenario, with the 27.6 hours following onset of heat. Now, let's look at this one, experiment two. 4 hours and 24 hours is the breeding. The median accessory sperm is 1 for 4 hours, 15. It went up as normal. So did fertility, 68 to 78. But remember now, ovulation is 31 plus or minus 2.9 hours, which is later, and it's tighter. In this scenario, again, fertilization went up at the 24, but there was no change in embryo quality. Okay? Even though it was 24 hours breeding this time, that was not the case with the previous one. But ovulation was postponed. So what the point I'm making is that in different scenarios that you are confronted with, you have to deal with, okay, if I'm going to switch from this system to another, am I changing ovulation? Am I tightening it? Or am I not? And the last case, the 24-hour insemination extended that peak to out there. Okay, I want to... So what are we dealing with? If we go back to the sperm transport, if you remember, basically, if this is the first standing heat, and here's ovulation, as it would be in the first scenario. Here it is in the second. It's later, but less variation. The main thing is we have to give the sperm time to get to the oviduct. And remember what that time was. It was about 4 to 6 hours. If we went back to that, for what we call that sperm transport, that sustained transport that took the sperm to the oviduct. So if we put that 6 hours in front, then we see that we can get closer to ovulation in the tight ovulation at 31 as opposed to where the eggs are coming out over a longer period of time. Here's another way of looking at it. In the we could breed to the first ovulation, which was 27 plus or minus 5 hours, okay, 5 to 15 hours following that first sign of heat. In the second scenario, where we are dealing with 31 plus or minus 3 or 28 to 34. We can go 12 to 22 hours after. Okay, so when ovulation is occurring and the distribution is important, and one has to start adding it, not at the average ovulation, but where they begin to come out, so that basically you are catching these eggs in the beginning as well. Okay. The bulls are really different, and this is the bull interaction. Here is a bull at 0, 12, 24 hours. Here you can see the accessory sperm on this axis, the time of insemination on this axis. And bull A, he covered the waterfront. He got sperm to the egg at 0 hours, 21, 32, and when you used him naturally, it went up to 73. In bull B, 0, 0, 4. In other words, breeding bull B and bull C late were both optimum. Now, you didn't hurt bull A, but you would have helped all three if you bred at 24 hours in that case. The natural service, this difference here, you can see a definite advantage to both these bulls, but no advantage in natural to that one. So, again, how would that look on this chart? Bull A, he covered the waterfront. Bull B and C, you had to breed closer to ovulation to optimize. By moving A close to ovulation, didn't hurt him. In other words, basically, you have to get as close to ovulation as you can, but with the idea that you don't want to what? Get so close that the sperm do not have time to get to the site of fertilization. You need that 4 to 6 hour lead time in front of ovulation. I just want to show this is older data from McMillan and Watson in Australia, and something similar, very similar here, that when they bred early in estrus, mid estrus, and late, you can see how the non-return rate or fertilization rate went up. In one of their bulls, or their high fertility bulls, it was high in the beginning as well. It almost went across straight. So it gives us the two sets of data. It gives us the feeling that one of the reasons you've got a high fertility bull is that they basically have a bigger window over which you can breed them and maximize fertility. So coming down to the end, the characteristics of a highly fertile bull, basically one that can stay high from onset of heat through rather than have that arch. This guy is something we want to definitely go after. The other is the portion of incompetent fertilizing sperm. The high fertility bull has few incompetent sperm as opposed to the low fertility bull, particularly at all doses. And how do we detect the low fertility bull that's incompensable or non-compensable? By morphology. Morphology will tell us when he has perturbed spermatogenesis. So this just summarizes that the bull, the reliability of the source is important to you. Their evaluation of morphology, and that's true in natural service bulls with BSEs, minimizing the uncompensable sperm morphology, and that you have successful cryopreservation. Make sure the inseminator is trained in both placement and semen handling, and don't be afraid to retrain someone who's got that responsibility. Time of insemination, know the time and tightness of ovulation. Being sure one inseminates at least 4 to 6 or 6 to 10 hours prior to the onset of heat. I want to thank you a lot for your attention. I have a lot of people to thank for this data, including some in this room. Randall Henshaw was instrumental in helping with that Ciroli timing data. And a lot of these other people are not here, but bless their hearts for hanging in that long. We also acknowledge the support for all of this work by Select Sires, NAAB, and the Virginia Ag Council. Thank you.